Hi, everyone. Just before we get into today's show, I wanted to say what a fantastic response we've had to our Sunday, the 13th of November live show in London, which we announced last week exclusively, yes, exclusively at the moment to Rest Is History Club members. There's still another week or so to buy tickets while the show is ring-fenced for friends of the show like yourselves at a discount price. And there's a chance we might even sell out before tickets go on sale to the public. So if you do want to come, please, please don't put it off. Dig out the ticket link on your email or click on it in the show notes and then simply enter the code RESTISHISTORY22, RESTISHISTORY22 at checkout for 10% off the price. And obviously, if it does end up being a members-only crowd, then as an event, it will be, well, I mean, basically, it'll be sacral. And who knows, Dominic might even get to do that long-awaited impersonation of Paddington Bear. So, Sunday, the 13th of November, London, The Rest Is History, live on stage. Ticket link in bio. See you there.
Hello and welcome to the latest Rest Is History bonus episode. As you can probably tell, I have the most horrendous cold, so my voice gives out before the end. Tom will just talk on his own, which I imagine, Tom, you'd probably quite enjoy, wouldn't you?
Well, you're moaning on about how ill you are. Only one of us has had COVID this week.
Yeah,
that's true. That's me.
It's true. How are you feeling?
I feel fine. But that's because I'm just incredibly brave and I don't moan.
Well, is that being an elite sportsman?
Yeah, it is. It is. Well, it's and quite tense for me because the biggest fixture of the year is coming up, which is the summer solstice match against Avebury.
Right.
You play in front of the great earthwork mound that surrounds right. The stones. It's a fabulous setting. And so, if you're batting, you can go and wander around the stones while you wait to bat. It's right. Fabulous. So okay. We'll be there on Sunday if you're in the Avebury area. Come and watch some elite sport. So on the Discord this week, there seems to be lots of chat about music, which, Dominic, you have written about. So people, a debate about what was the best decade for music in the late 20th and early 21st century. And I know that we're not a music podcast.
Not by any means.
But we have done an episode on the Beatles, haven't we? So
we have indeed.
And music has historically been very significant. So Lee Kuan Yew, Respecter, the 70s was the best decade because it had yacht rock.
What's yacht rock?
I don't know, but the Kaiser would.
Yeah, it depends on the attire, doesn't it?
I thought yacht rock, isn't that Duran Duran?
I was thinking Duran Duran, Rio. But maybe not. Maybe that's not. Shall I look it up?
Oh, Dom has just said yacht rock refers to the soft rock that dominated FM radio airwaves in the late 1970s and early 1980s.
Yeah, it gave birth, Tom, to something called chill wave and vapor wave, according to Wikipedia.
Oh, great. Okay.
I don't know.
Well, so how do you think the Kaiser would cope with that?
I don't see the Kaiser as a popular music.
I mean, so Simon Le Bon would be there, all, you know, with his shades and everything. And the Kaiser would turn up in full military uniform.
He would do, yeah. And God knows what Graf Dietrich von Hülsenhäusler would.
I think he'd blend in perhaps a little bit.
Well,
better.
He's a bit glam rock, isn't he?
Yes,
he is. He's sort of the David Bowie era.
But I think if wearing the wrong deck shoes precipitated the First World War, I mean, God knows what turning up in full military uniform for yacht rock would do.
So, Tom, what's your answer to this question? I mean, it's a very pub quiz question, isn't it, this? So they had a poll on Discord, the 60s, 70s, 80s or 90s. What are you going to go for?
60s, of course. I mean, 60s is obviously the best. By miles, it's the great revolutionary decade.
Yeah,
I think changes, 60s, transforms music.
60s is the best, but not the most, not my favourite. Does that make
sense? Well, that's not the same thing.
No, they're very different things.
Completely different things.
Yeah.
I mean, your favourite always tends to be what the stuff that you listen to when you're very young.
Of course. I think the 60s objectively is the most innovative, isn't it? So even though you might well argue that there might be better stuff produced in the 70s, they're standing on the shoulders of what's been done in the 60s. Exactly. Yeah.
And when you did your histories,
yeah,
how important is the music to the fabric of the portrait of the age that you give?
I think it ebbs and flows, actually, Tom. So I think there are moments. I think, by the way, right now it's not important at all. I mean, that sounds like a massive sweeping statement, and lots of people might well say, well, how can you possibly say that? But I think music has lost any political salience, hasn't it? I mean,
but do you think also it's because with streaming and the collapse of the charts. And,
yeah, absolutely.
It's just kind of a blur.
It is.
Or is that the perspective that we have as middle-aged people?
No, I think it's definitely a blur. And I think you're absolutely right. There's been a fragmentation of a kind of cultural narrative. And so when I talked about it ebbing and flowing, there are definitely moments. So 1963 to 64, let's say, the classic one, the Beatles moment, when suddenly mainstream conversation, kind of, you know, staid newspapers, The Times, The Guardian, The Telegraph, yeah, are reporting this new phenomenon, are sort of mining it for political significance.
And the Beatles going to America is, of course.
Politicians are quoting, you know, the 1964 election campaign in Britain. Both leaders, Alec Douglas Hume and Harold Wilson, quoted the Beatles. You know, everybody knows who they are, and everybody has an opinion. So that's true of that moment. It's also true, I think, again, in a weird way, of punk in 1976, 77. So you see punk being used as a metaphor for Britain. You see lots of political cartoons depicting kind of the Jim Callaghan cabinet.
With safety pins.
It's safety pins. Yeah. So suddenly there's a point where everybody, even if they've never listened to a punk record, knows what, you know, what punk is. And I suppose in the mid-1990s, let's say, in Britain, remember the Oasis blur.
Yeah, the Spice Girls probably even bigger.
Yeah, Spice Girls.
I mean, because the Spice Girls served as a kind of, almost became a kind of meme.
Yeah, the Cool Britannia.
Britain, yeah.
But I think since then, has there been any moment, has there been a movement that has caught mainstream, non-musically interested people's attention? I would say probably not. Do you think? I mean, certainly there's been no sort of cult that has seized the sort of and stamped itself upon the zeitgeist.
I do think that, but I'm also aware that effectively what I'm saying is at the moment I had children, music ceased to be important.
But Tom, I think the point is, though, it's not just middle-aged men saying, oh, it's not in my day, because the whole point was that in the 1960s, in 1963, 64, even people who were grandparents knew who the Beatles were.
I agree with you, but I'm also just...
You're just too keen not to... You're too worried about sounding uncool.
No, I have no qualms about sounding uncool. I don't know anything about music now.
But that, I think, tells its own story.
But I'm very happy to embrace my middle age. I don't want to kind of pretend that I'm still 20. You are right, because these are not... Music is not intruding in the mainstream.
I think there are sort of the cultural conversation, the national cultural conversation only has room for so many threads, as it were. And I think for younger people, I mean, of course, there are loads of people who are passionately interested in music. You know, it defines them and all that sort of stuff. But I think, for example, for boys, video games are now colossal. You know, they actually style themselves after avatars and things in a way that they wouldn't have done 10 or 20 years ago.
So if you were writing a history of Britain over the past decade, you would focus more on computer games than on music?
Excellent question. A social history. I'm not sure.
You're the history that you do, whether it's
sort of social
culture
history,
it's all woven in.
I struggle to see how I would integrate music into a story that had kind of Brexit in it and Boris Johnson.
But you would, for instance, include Love Island.
So Love Island I would include, absolutely. Reality TV that has X million people watching it and also everybody talking about it.
Yeah.
In a way that they're not talking about
music. And it tells you something about technology as well, doesn't it?
It does indeed,
changing social mores.
Exactly, yes. Yeah. Or indeed the sort of social... media memes and all those kinds of things.
And we should say that the reason that Love Island is on both our minds is that we've just finished recording an episode of Love Island. And should we give the listeners a sneak preview of one of the couples who ended up? Five hunks, five babes. Dominic and I each chose five.
Sure.
We don't want to spoil it for people, do we?
I think we've got some. Well, instead of talking about the couples, we could talk about a couple of the contenders, maybe. So, I mean, Dom, our producer, is saying give them a teaser.
Give them a teaser. That's very Love
Island,
isn't
it? I think few people will have expected that President Carter would appear on Love Island, but he has.
And done pretty well for himself, actually. We won't say who he has paired up with, but
yeah.
I think it's above his pay grade.
It is above his pay grade.
And I think that the most improbable pairing is a Roman empress and a much loved 1930s British prime minister.
Yeah.
So that, Dominic, you were very happy about.
Yeah. We've got a biblical character.
We've got
well-known biblical character.
We've got a couple of classical kind of queens stroke empresses. We've got a famous poet.
A US Civil War general.
We have a couple of dancers. Yes, we have a US Civil War general. Very, very exciting.
Tom is incredibly, I have to say, Tom is underplaying the level of excitement because he's been ringing me up about this at all hours in a state of tremendous agitation, discussing the rubric and stuff. And I think that it's fair to say the rubric
did work.
Well, it did work, but I mean, we've recorded the first episode and we still haven't agreed on the actual format of the show. So might think we've approached it in the wrong order.
So we did it with my daughter, Katie, who had to go to work at 9. So we didn't manage to get everything in that we wanted to. So we haven't quite worked out exactly how the episode will be stitched together, whether there'll be two. But having recorded the first one where there are 10 contenders that we haven't talked about at all on the show before, the plan is to introduce much-loved fan favourites from previous episodes.
I think
see how they would get on.
I mean, one thing I will say for those people who think this is absolute gibberish and babble is to reassure you, this is not taking the place of our traditional content, is it, Tom? Because we've also yesterday recorded, you know, one of our hardest hitting, heaviest series yet, which is the American Civil War.
4 episodes.
And the importance of slavery and what it meant for Black Americans in the South, the course of the war, the geopolitics of it, the cultural impacts, the memory of the lost cause, all this stuff. So we did a colossal 4-hour marathon, didn't we? So I think we sort of earned
the right. But again, sticking up for the Love Island episode, it's really an excuse to discuss 10 remarkable figures characters. From history, 10 remarkable characters. And I think you will find all of them very, very interesting. Right, that's enough about future episodes. Let's look at episodes to come. But before we do that, one other comment, which is from Callum. Tom and Dominic seem to have pissed off an odd group of people. Peter Hitchens, Alexi Sale, Andrew Marr, even some random dinner guest who didn't like Tom's reading of Chamberlain's funeral eulogy. I can't imagine anyone disliking them. Well, that's very sweet of
that's
you.
Very sweet,
I can assure you that plenty of people dislike us.
Yeah, I think if you dig deep into academic Twitter, you'll find plenty of people.
Peter Hitchens, the truth is that obviously I have heard of him. I just thought that pretending I hadn't would be the pettiest, most underhand way of getting back. He just had a shout at me. He had a rant at me.
What was he cross with you about, Tom?
He thought that I was not sufficiently playing up the degree to which Ukraine is fascist.
Oh, God, he's done that to me as well.
Yeah.
I've had that, but I just ignored it. I just completely ignored it.
I then ignored him, and it was so cross that I was ignoring him that he just did this massive rant about how I was thick and I smelt of poo, basically, was the level of the engagement. Andrew Marr, you pissed off because you gave him a bad review or a lukewarm review.
A lukewarm review.
And Alexi Sale because... because of your Marxism, he didn't like it.
Yeah, clearly.
Anyway.
Alexi Sale was, it's funny going on to TV. I mean, as you know, Tom, from doing TV yourself, you can stir up I didn't stir up anything like the furore that you did.
Yeah, you didn't get multiple death threats.
No, but when you go on to TV, I mean, lots of people who've never heard of you are suddenly exposed to you and are sort of appalled and shocked by your very existence. So Alexi Sale was cross because I was too young to have done the history of the 1980s. That was one of his things.
You said the most significant woman of the 1980s was Delia Smith.
Which was obviously a joke. How did he not get that? Anyway, when we did a series before that about the 1970s, there was a review in Metro. And Metro was absolutely appalled by this series, thought it was terrible. And
Metro's the downmarket Evening Standard, right?
Metro is the free newspaper, exactly. And the reviewer for Metro said, historians, the definition of historians, people who weren't there passing themselves off as experts.
Well, they rumbled that.
Yeah.
On which topic? Let's get to Robin Hood.
Yes, we weren't there. I don't think we would claim to be experts, but that seemed to go down quite well, didn't it, Robin Hood? And Relax OK says, feels like there could have been 2 or 3 more podcasts on the subject. They didn't really get into the Sheriff of Nottingham. It's true, we didn't really mention the Sheriff much other than...
There's nothing to say about him.
Well, he's
from Nottingham.
Is he just a cartoon villain, Tom, or is there more political significance to him than that?
No, he's just, I mean, he's the figure of authority.
So the sheriff is there right from the beginning, isn't he?
Yeah, That's right. In the earliest, yeah.
And he's purely a figure of authority, a sort of generic.
Yeah.
He doesn't have a...
He's the person who arrests Robin Hood. I mean, he's there to kick the plot along.
But he's not there, he doesn't have a satirical meaning, let's say, that would have been obvious to medieval folk ballad enthusiasts, but it's not there, not obvious to us.
The only example of that I can think of is that when Little John and Much the Miller's Son turn up, having killed the monk and his page boy, they trick the sheriff into thinking that they've come from the king, and the sheriff toasts them with the best wine in the cellar, and you get the sense that perhaps there's some kind of in joke, some joke that.
Yeah.
That would make sense to people that we're perhaps not entirely getting, but it's hard to know what it is. So I don't think there is actually much more to say about the sheriff, because he exists to serve as a kind of counterpoint to Robin.
Yeah.
And that's basically his role.
But Tom, what there is more to say about is your extraordinary theory.
It's not mine.
That the Robin Coots. Hood stories are all about devotion to the Virgin Mary. So Jeanette agrees with me. She doesn't like the theory. I speak as a devout Christian and recent Catholic convert. She says, boo to that idea. Now, I noticed there are other people on Twitter who were sort of, there was somebody who said, you know, I shared Dominic Sambrook's mounting horror and shock as Tom Holland unveiled his great theory at the end.
So what I will say is it's absolutely not my theory. I in no way pretend to be... an expert on the evolution of medieval poetic traditions. But this is the theory put forward by Leslie Coote, who is absolutely world expert on the subject. And what I will say is that a lot of the response I got on Twitter to it was from specialists in the field saying how much they had enjoyed it and tipping the hat to the mentions of Leslie Coote.
Oh, that's good. That's nice.
So I was quite happy about that, because I'll be honest. I mean, you know, that what everything I had to say on that was the fruit of kind of 2 or 3 weeks worth reading.
Weeks? That's some... Had you really been preparing the Robin Hood podcast for 2 or 3 weeks?
Yeah, I read a lot for it.
That puts my own contributions to the podcast in a new light, Tom. I'm feeling ashamed.
I mean, I'm very, very interested in it. And yeah. I kind of did know about it, but I hadn't read about it for, you know, maybe couple of decades.
Right.
So I was behind the curve on where the latest sinking was. So it was a great opportunity to catch up with it. But because, you know, being a specialist enables you to situate advanced theories from scholars, new theories from scholars within the broader context, I wasn't able to do that. So I wouldn't stand here and say that I absolutely know that she's right or wrong. I'm not qualified to say that. All I can do is say that is what she says, and it seems to be a theory that is... It's not being laughed at. Let's put it that way. It's
okay.
It's had quite a lot of credence.
All right. Shall we move on to the prime ministers?
Oh, can we just have Tartan Wookie?
Oh, go on. Tell Tartan Wookie's story.
My favorite Robin Hood anecdote concerns a young bride who, in the early 90s, requested the Robin Hood song for her walk down the aisle, fully expecting to hear Bryan Adams crooning "Everything I Do." She was a little bit surprised to find herself advancing on her attendant to the rousing Robin Hood riding through the glen, which I think is a great story.
That is a good story. Ted Valance, who's I went to his wedding. And the wedding music that they had was the music from The Empire Strikes Back.
Really?
Yeah.
Why did they choose that?
Why? They love The Empire Strikes Back.
Oh, fair enough.
Absolutely love. And they had scenes from The Empire Strikes Back playing on big screens.
Goodness.
It was very impressive.
I imagine that, judging by his name, Tartan Wookie would approve of that.
He would. All right, How Prime Ministers Fall. So this was obviously an emergency podcast. We did it at sort of 9:05 at night.
I mean, we have to say the Prime Minister has not yet fallen, has he?
No, though I still think he'll be gone by the end of the year, actually. I mean, maybe listeners will be able to, you know, I'm a terrible political pundit. If you go back through my political punditry, almost all my forecasts end up in absolute shambles. But I think he will be gone eventually. I mean, he's still there now. He's clinging on. But I thought that was a really interesting opportunity, actually, to talk about how prime ministers fall and how you spend your political capital.
Yeah.
And there are very few, I mean, there really aren't examples in history, I think, of people who, in British history, of people who are so badly wounded and then recover.
Well, you've delivered a mea culpa. I must as well, because I did the analogy of the Komodo dragon biting on a deer or a bull, and supposedly the quality of its bite is so toxic that it has so much bacteria in its mouth that it infects them, and then they kind of die 2 or 3 weeks later, and then the Komodo dragon eats it. And I did this on the basis of a Nature documentary that I'd watched about 20 years ago, but it turns out that this has now been superseded, and apparently the Komodo dragon does actually have toxins within its mouth, so it's poisonous.
Okay,
I apologize for that.
We're not a nature podcast though, Tom.
No, we're not. We're not. But we still, it'd be nice to get our nature details right. So Three Bottle Man.
Yes.
Maybe there should be a World Cup of Worst Politicians, an emergency podcast brilliantly done. Oh, thank you, Three Bottle Man. That's kind.
Worst Politicians. The funny thing there is that if you get to be Prime Minister, I think you have to have something.
Yeah.
I mean, even the worst Prime Ministers had some quality let's say Boris Johnson, for example, because lots of listeners will probably say, oh, he's terrible. They hate him. Not all of them, of course. But those who do, he obviously has strengths as a communicator, as a campaigner. You don't get to be top of the tree unless your top trump card has some high scores on it.
Well, that's why I think a World Cup of Worst Monarchs is more interesting, that's much more like the draw.
Yeah,
Agree. If you rise to high office, You can't just be absolutely hopeless. You have to have qualities.
I think that's true of former Secretary of State of Education for Education, Gavin Williamson. I think he had notable qualities.
Well, he had a kind of a little black book, didn't he?
Oh, of course he did. Yeah, he's a good plotter.
He'd been the chief whip, so he's a kind of Francis Urquhart figure.
Yeah.
So he had obviously had a kind of talent for blackmail.
Do you know my Gavin Williamson fact?
No.
So my son does this club. This sort of school club, they meet on Saturday mornings. And there's always a different theme. So it's out of school. And a different theme each term. And last term's theme was in politics. They had to invent their own political party in sort of little groups. And then they were going to present all the political parties to the parents, and we'd vote on our favourites. And as part of this sort of exercise, the teacher said at the beginning, we have secured you a chance to speak to a top politician.
Oh, no.
And we weren't allowed to know who that was going to be until the day. And anyway, he went and did it. And I said, who was the absolutely top politician? He said, it was Gavin Williamson. Post-sacking, he said it was Gavin Williamson. And he did it on Zoom on his phone from the car park at Asda.
Oh, the glamour of politics.
Yeah.
Well, I think I that's a useful lesson for any young aspirant politician to learn.
Yes.
That you may end up talking to schools on a phone from a car park. Xander Fearon has an excellent point, a really excellent point. A shame Dominic didn't think Peel was charismatic. Carlyle met him in the late 1840s and said he made incredibly good conversation at dinner.
Yeah. So I may have to hold my hand up and say mea culpa on that. I reviewed a book many years ago by Douglas Hurd, biography of Robert Peel. And I seem to have got from that the sense that Peel was a bit colourless. But maybe I just misremembered. I mean, I don't know. Maybe he's also eclipsed by Disraeli. But I had sort of absorbed this sense that Peel was a little bit chilly and a little bit distant. But maybe, Xander, I'm completely wrong. I mean, mind you, is Carlyle? I mean, Carlyle's quite a character. I don't know whether Carlyle would be the person I would go to for conversationalist tips.
He just kind of shout at you and very, very long sentences. And you wouldn't want to give him your manuscript either, would you? Because he does
that'd be terrible.
So Roll, wonderful episode. Thank you, Roll. Dominic's disdain for Lloyd George put me in mind of a rhyme that was recited by a politics tutor when I was at university. Not sure what the ultimate attribution is, though. Lloyd George, no doubt, when his life ebbs out, will ride in a flaming chariot, seated in state on a red-hot plate twixt Satan and Judas Iscariot.
That's good. Very good.
Harold Stassen, was Palmerston the last PM to die in office? Supposedly deflowering a parlour maid on a billiard table.
Yes, I think almost certainly not true, unfortunately. Not true. I think he was, because I think although both Campbell Bannerman and Bonner Law died, I think they had formally left the office before they died, you know, when they were terminally ill. So I think probably Palmerston was the last person to die, as it were, in the saddle, unfortunate phrase given the urban myth. Yeah, I think so. But I suppose conventionally we say Campbell Bannerman and Bonar Law sort of died semi in office because they left just, you know, when they knew the game was up.
And Greg Noonan, if the Harold Wilson exception was worth including, how about a prime minister who ditches his party, i.e. Ramsay MacDonald? I mean, Dominic, you know I had firm views on Harold Wilson.
And Harold Wilson, yes, as being not eligible. Ramsay MacDonald would be an absolutely excellent subject for the podcast, because I know 1930s, the intricacies of 1930s high politics, Tom, are not really your thing. But MacDonald is a fascinating character, because, of course, he's from such, he's probably from the humblest background. He's the first Labour Prime Minister. But he's also the person who, I mean, you can argue he is so, he's both so instrumental in building the Labour Party up, and of course, taking him into office and power.
Well, let's do him.
But then, Tom, the thing that's so interesting about him is he becomes the sort of paradigmatic example of that perennial Labour obsession, treachery.
Yeah,
the traitor who sells out to capitalism. So,
can we do him this summer?
Sure. Yeah, the MacDonald and the all of that. Fascinating.
No,
of
I think
course,
that'd
it
be
brings
great.
Us a chance to bring on Stanley Baldwin once again.
I know it does.
Yes,
a lot of boxes.
A lot of boxes. Yeah, it'd be
okay,
great.
Well, let's do that this summer. Or maybe we could do it to coincide with the Labour Party conference.
Brilliant. That's what we'll do. The let's first do Labour Prime Minister for the Labour Party conference.
Yeah, let's do that. Okay. And then we did one other episode we did on the first fascist, with which is Gabriele D'Annunzio with Lucy Hughes Hallett. I thought was a wonderful guest. Andrew H., fascinating to hear his poetry is on the school curriculum in Italy. I wonder if they learn about his background. Who would be the closest equivalent in the UK or the USA? Ezra Pound? I can't imagine his poetry getting anywhere near a classroom here. I mean, yeah. Ezra Pound is, I guess, the only avowed fascist. I mean, well, so D'Annunzio didn't define himself as a fascist, but...
But D'Annunzio is such a colossal figure in Italian letters. I mean, he's far greater.
Well, I would say the parallel is Kipling.
That is very cruel to Roger.
No, I'm not saying that D'Annunzio and Kipling are comparable politically, but they are massive figures.
Yeah.
You know, colossal literary figures.
Yeah.
Enormously famous in their own time, globally recognized, still vast figures within, you know, I mean, Kipling's status as a short story writer and as a poet seems to me indisputable.
Yeah.
And yet he is simply not studied at all at school or at university.
I think you're probably right. And
he has basically, you know, he's not studied, I think, because he is seen as a kind of jingo imperialist.
Kipling is an absolutely brilliant writer, though. I mean,
yeah, he is.
Some of his short stories, and actually the funny thing is I don't really like the Indian short stories very much. Some of the ones, because I find that quite wearing, all that sort of slightly twee, you know, the endless lists and the strange, you know,
Some of the Indian ones are brilliant.
Mock archaic language. But I think some of the
ones set in Simla, and
that's a good story. And some of the short stories set in Britain are brilliant. And of course, there is that absolutely heartbreaking story, The Gardener, which I think it's impossible to read without crying.
I think that Andrew H. is right. I think that Kipling has been removed from the curriculum pretty much.
Maybe. Although Kipling, I don't know how much this is true of D'Annunzio, but Kipling is so woven into the sort of national collective imagination, The Jungle Book. I mean, obviously this is partly through because of Disney and there's been a controversy recently, hasn't there, about If and its use at Wimbledon, because famously it's equated with Wimbledon. It's kind of,
You see it as you go out
on the center court. Exactly. And some of the women players have said, "You'll be a man, my son," all that kind of stuff. They don't like it. They want it to say, "You'll be a person, my whatever, my son or daughter." I mean, it sounds like I'm making light of their objection. And let's be frank, I kind of am. Yeah. So you're right. I mean, Kipling, I suppose he's embattled, isn't he? He's embattled.
I'm dredging this from the back of my mind, and it's quite a Daily Mail story, so maybe you remember better. But there was some student union in Manchester or something where it had been written, and it got erased and replaced with a Mayor Angelou poem, I think, or something like that.
Kipling is pound for pound, arguably one of the two or three greatest British writers of the period from, let's say, I don't know, 1870 to 1940, I would argue.
He must run kind of the King James Bible, Shakespeare, can't think who else, in terms of, you know, phrases that everyone recognises.
Yeah, agreed. Tom, we should do a podcast about Kipling. I mean,
yeah, we should, definitely.
So we've got Ramsay MacDonald, we've got Rudyard Kipling. Yeah. It's great.
Brecht, maybe another would be another interesting.
Yes.
So Brecht, I found it interesting how she struggled to reconcile, so that would be Lucy, to reconcile his violent attitude to women in general with his apparent respect and admiration for a select group of women he considered talented. Looking at it from a distance, that seems very similar to his views about men, a select few of great men he considered his equal, and all the rest mere cannon fodder, whose main purpose was to be sacrificed in the service of these great men. Yeah, I think that's true.
Yeah, I think that is true. I think Lucy loves, I mean, Lucy obviously reads Italian. She loves D'Annunzio's writing. She recognizes that he's a brilliant poet, and she talks about the beauty of his verse. But as she said, one of the fascinating things with studying D'Annunzio is it really forces you to re-examine the idea that great people make great art, or nice people make great art. Because
what is greatness? Which is a question with which we began, Dominic.
With which we've wrestled ourselves. Now, I think D'Annunzio was an absolutely repellent human being, but clearly a brilliant man at the same time. And I think that's that. I love that, because I think, you know, too often we make this very facile equation between virtue and talent, don't we? And we have the sort of fantasy of the romantic artist in the garret and all this sort of stuff. But
the romantic artist is often self-consciously bad.
Yeah.
You know, shaking his fist at the heavens. That's a kind of important part of the myth. And D'Annunzio, in that sense, is a kind of late romantic.
Yeah.
Even though I know he's, you know, obsessed by modernity.
But of course, he's Nietzschean. And I think that's really, really interesting. The fact that he believes he's a Superman, doesn't he?
Definitely another topic we should do.
Nietzsche. Definitely. Yeah. Well, have you written about Nietzsche and Dominion, haven't you?
I have. Nietzsche's a massive, massive influence on Dominion.
Yeah. Because he's the first person, you basically argue, don't you? He's the first person who is genuinely, genuinely un-Christian. Is that right?
I think the Marquis de Sade, fascinating topic. I think the Marquis de Sade is as well. But Nietzsche is obviously much, much more kind of intellectually brilliant than the Marquis de Sade. Yeah. Nietzsche, I think, is he's the first properly post-Christian atheist.
Right. Yes. So the first one who's not really, who genuinely throws off the.
Yeah, and I think that his understanding of Christianity is much profounder than that of most Christians, which may sound a paradox, but I think probably isn't. So on the topic of D'Annunzio is a terrible man, Red Ant, you're right. There is absolutely nothing to redeem the man. He was a pig, even if he did write beautiful poetry. But the episode was enthralling for the story it told, remarkable for its insights into the origins of fascism.
Well, lots of people, you know, the funny thing we didn't really talk about was a lot of people are very uneasy with the idea that fascism began with the arts, because they, especially if they're kind of on the left, they think fascism began through the machinations of big business or whatever. But for example, one thing we didn't talk about with Lucy was John Carey, great sort of literary scholar, had a very controversial book called The Intellectuals and the Masses, where he, in some ways, was effectively arguing that fascism began in the scorn that intellectuals had for, intellectuals came to sort of venerate these things like violence and all these things that shocked conventional morality, almost as a way of proving their superiority over the common man in an age of the mass, in an age of mass culture and mass literacy and all those kinds of things.
But fascists took great pleasure in beating up intellectuals, didn't they?
They did, but it's interesting how many, I mean, in his book, Carey sort of says, you know, effectively, it's interesting how many people who are instrumental in creating fascism, D'Annunzio, Mussolini, Hitler, fancy themselves initially as artists.
Mm.
You know, think of them, they think they have a higher calling, they think they're idealists, they think they're better than ordinary people, all that sort of thing.
Last question from Edward BN, what is the origin of the term fascism? So the fasces were the rods that the lictors, who were the guards appointed to protect Roman magistrates, would wear over their shoulders. And the rods were symbols of the right of the magistrate to command a citizen to be beaten.
And then in the 19th century, because of the sort of idea of the binding together the rods, the word in Italy comes to mean a sort of it comes to me that kind of like a guild or a club or something. So by the time Mussolini picks up the word, which is sort of during the First World War, they have the, for example, what do they call them? The fasci di combattimento or something like that. So they're sort of clubs, they're kind of guilds, because obviously yeah. there's a kind of syndicalist aspect to Mussolini's thinking. They're sort of groups, societies, I suppose. And they use the word, obviously, because it's harking back to the Roman period, and it sort of conveys this air of dignity and antiquity because it's looking back to the days of the empire.
Well, there we go. So I think that's it for this week. So thank you very much for listening. As we say, we've got lots coming up. So
Tom, are we still doing Stonehenge?
We are. We're doing Stonehenge at the end of the week. So what is coming up? We've got Antony and Cleopatra on Thursday, so tomorrow.
Well, the club members will have that already.
Yes, of course. You've already heard it. Yes, you've all heard it. So Stonehenge will be going out Thursday week. And that is the summer solstice. So,
and what we've got banked that you have to look forward to, we've got pigeons. That's all done.
Yeah.
Orwell is done. And of course, the US Civil War epic. So loads of fun things.
The pigeons. I think it's actually a fantastic episode. Gordon Creagh is a wonderful guest. He knows everything about the role of the pigeon in history. His devotion to the pigeon, I think, shines through. You will listen to it and you will see pigeons in a new light. And my only disappointment was that we recorded it just as my COVID hit, and it was the one time I felt really ill. So I didn't enjoy it as much as
you didn't
I otherwise
do
would have done.
As many impersonations of pigeons as I thought. No,
I wasn't. I just wasn't up to it.
Though, I mean, actually, talking of impersonations, I know a lot of people really basically listen to the podcast because they think it's basically accents and a bit of history. We've got the US Civil War coming up, and very, very few impersonations in that. But it does have one that I think will go down as a landmark, which is Tom's Karl Marx.
Which actually opens the whole thing.
Yes.
And gives a rather...
it's an unexpected tone.
Yes. So it doesn't entirely correspond to the tone of the rest of what follows. On the topic of impressions, Dominic, just one last comment from Cy James. When it comes to impressions, Dominic is hiding his light under a bushel. His repertoire of voices in the audiobook version of Who Dares Wins would give Mike Yarwood a run for his money.
Well, that is kind. The one thing I'll say about that is it took more than 40 hours to record that audiobook. And there was definitely a point when we turned the page with the sound engineer who'd sat sort of manfully, dutifully through all this. And I turned the page. The next chapter was about the hunger strikes in Belfast in 1981. And before I could start, he just said laconically, "Don't. Just do it in your own voice."
Very, very sensible. And on that note, we will bid you farewell. We'll be back with the next episode next week. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.